my college didn't make it into the official addresses, so I had to put a picture of it there, sort of photo-doctored, so you can see, you know, that it's a real place. But what I'm going to talk about is perhaps a little speculative, but it's a little bit different direction from what I see most people going in terms of ontologies. And one might also call it metaphysics. Now, metaphysics in Aristotle's library is beside physics. So you might say, since I'm a physicist, I'm sort of beside myself this afternoon. But anyway, here's an outline, some preliminary remarks, some assumptions for the talk, some evidence for openness, primarily the quantum mechanical evidence, and I want to spend a little bit of time there. It's in an alternate color because I'm going to have a quantum interlude that's going to go rather rapidly, but my intent is not to make you understand everything, but to give you a flavor of how the argument goes, that's all. But I want to impress at the end that we really have an interesting situation in the quantum world, and then what should we be doing with that in terms of our theological understanding. And then I will follow that up with a teleological argument for openness, why I think that it makes every bit of sense to have openness in not only the quantum world, but in other worlds or aspects of creation. And then some implications and concluding remarks. Okay, so preliminary remarks. Why was I motivated to think about this issue in this way? Well, I was responding to a paper in another circumstance, which was a paper arguing from a Calvinist perspective for what he called psychological determinism, and I just didn't think that rings true. So I wanted to respond to that, and I'll give you a quote from that paper that indicates why I responded in this way. Also, there's been a lot of renewed interest in non-reductionist views of the world. Emergence, there's a lot of interest in emergence. If you go to other conferences, you might see that theme as a theme. The mind-body dualism problem has always been a problem for people trying to put together the whole big picture. And you don't think that you can reduce the mind to the body, usually, in those discussions. And there are also empirical arguments and then some intuition, gut feelings, and I think sometimes we really should trust our intuition when we're tempted to do otherwise. There's also ongoing interest in the openness in the connection of divine action, and this is there are many things written on that in the last several years. Now, I'd like to say up front that I think we should be, as much as possible, we should avoid, as Christians, being reductionists. And I'll talk a little more about that, but that's why I say that Christian theology suggests a non-reductionist ontology. And then the real issue there is why let the implications of science of today, if we tend to be in a mechanistic mindset, which we really still are in this century, left over from the 19th century, why let those dictate our interpretation of ontology when they may may show up wrong tomorrow, particularly in some of these issues about emergence in mind-body and so on. Okay, so here are some assumptions that I'm going to make. I'm making these as assumptions not because I don't have arguments for some of them, although there are a couple I'm still working on, but because I've already made arguments in a book that I published with a colleague a few years ago. The first one is the one that I don't have as strong an argument. I'm just going to make it as an assumption today, that we're going to be considering a non-reductionist ontology, and we'll talk about what that is opposed to. There's a hierarchy of aspects of nature or creation, as you will, and there are laws accordingly that we will be able to study in every one of those aspects. I'm also going to assume a particular theological backdrop. This is very much discussed in our book. That is, the whole interpretation of our understanding of science should take place in this backdrop of the creation, fall, redemption story that God is orchestrating through his purposes, and his purposes are being carried out according to his will. And so within that theological backdrop, that means that all of nature, including the laws of nature, are God's active working sustaining of his creation, all of nature. And so we're not looking for his divine action somewhere. And that's why I consider the question of where is God acting in nature, what is the divine action, I consider that a pseudo-problem. It's just a false problem. God is acting everywhere all the time. and we have to see that with the eye of faith. Now, a dualistic mindset might consider, and this is in opposition to my attitude, a dualistic mindset might consider the mechanistic attitude towards nature, where there are sort of built-in laws of nature, and then God is, you know, God sort of already set them running, and they're just running along. And then beyond that, there is his action somewhere else in the world, miracles, whatever else you want. But I consider this a kind of deism, maybe with some supernatural interposed stuff. And my view is that the laws of nature are regularities that follow from God's active and continual sustenance and his covenant faithfulness to his creation. We saw this afternoon in the plenary session about God's covenant with creation, and this is where I'm taking that. And all these themes under the theological backdrop are published in the book that I'll have on the next slide. The final point here is that I consider God working at every moment through his Spirit presence in the world. This is the Spirit of Christ dispatched in the world. It's not only Spirit of redemption, but it's a Spirit of creation. And those points are also made, argued in our book. So that's just assumptions that I'm making, and I want to go on beyond those assumptions for this talk. All right, so what is a non-reductionist ontology? Simply put, it's one in which the behavior or the laws or the empirical evidence in higher levels is not reducible to that of lower levels. What do we mean by levels? Well, consider the situation of physicalism. Everything is reduced to physics. And so you have the material, and then you've got the laws that govern that material, and somehow everything can be explained in terms of that. And that would be a reductionist view. Now, I want to claim that we inherit a kind of reductionist physicalism from our mechanistic heritage of the 19th century. Whenever I ask my students, how do you think about nature? This is how they think about nature. And it remains a habit of the mind for many of us, even scientists, I think. It remains a habit of the mind in terms of thinking about the world, even though perhaps if we are more informed by theology, it would not. So now I have a few motivations about why to assume a non-reductionist ontology. I already mentioned arguments concerning emergence. There are some of those arguments that could be closet reductionist arguments, emergence where the collective phenomena that comes out of a lower level set of laws is not really genuinely new, but we think it looks kind of new. But some of them may have some genuine directions toward real new emergence coming out. In some sense, that's the whole is greater than the parts. In physical science, you see this collective phenomena. There are a lot of examples of collective phenomena, but those are the ones that are not really new phenomena, except they're governed by the same laws that we understand. In biological science, there might be some relation to design arguments here. I haven't really tried to work that out yet. As I mentioned in the psychology and the mind-body problem, there's a lot of discussion. For example, Nancy Murphy out at Fuller Seminary has been working on can you reduce the body, the mind to the body, and whether the body actually determines the mind, and her feeling is that it doesn't. I have a quote from her that's kind of nice. But she talks a lot about top-down causality. So that would be causality from the top, coming from the mind and psychology and so on, affecting and causing things on the bottom level. Now, I want to say that that's all good and well, but it's still causality, and the quantum world has a kind of a different flavor than causality, which is even a little bit more curious. And then there are some empirical arguments. There's my Dutch Reformed stuff coming out. Intelligent design arguments, as I said, may be related to this, but non-reductionism has a long history in the Dutch Reformed tradition. Some of you know the philosopher Duyvaert, Vollenhoven, and some of those. And one of the arguments they make is that if you actually study the different aspects of creation, and you begin to isolate what the differences are by running into antinomies, because you try to make reductions and they don't really work. So there's a philosophical argument behind that, which I'm not really talking about. But the gut feelings are the most fun one, the intuition, all right? And so here's a quote from Nancy Murphy, and I really resonate with this. This is in the preface of her book of a few years ago, Did My Neurons Make Me Do It? Neurobiological reductionism has to be false. If not, then what may appear to be a product of rational processes must instead be the consequence of causal processes in the brain. If this is the case, arguments for neurobiological reductionism are not, in fact, arguments, but mere noises. And while we did not judge there to be fully adequate response to this problem at the time we began on the project, we recognized a growing body of helpful resources in the literature, and then they proceeded to go on and work out and write the book and try to argue against that position of reductionism, which and there's some very valuable contributions there. All right, so back to this. I think maybe the biggest issue for Christians that a materialist, atheist, agnostic, whoever it is, but just assuming about a material world, has no God in the picture, is not free to posit anything going on other than a material world. And Christians, we know that there is something going on other than a material world, and that is God working in the world. And so we are free to posit a non-reductionist perspective, and in fact it may be true. Of course, it's an empirical question as we approach what we're finding, whether or not it really sticks. But somebody like Richard Dawkins just doesn't have that freedom. So I think that is something that we as Christians need to keep in mind when we're doing our science, is that we do have that freedom to ask questions that others might not be able to ask. Okay, so now I'm moving to the quantum interim, you might say. And this is going to go by fast, but I want you to get a flavor for what the quantum world is like. All right, quantum mechanics is very strange, and it appears to describe the world with remarkable accuracy. Those seem to be sort of opposites. The point here is to get across how strange it really is. Now, the uncertainty principle, most of you have heard of, right? Everybody? It's sort of strange. It's not really that bad. It's waves behave that way. But entanglement, how many have heard of that? So most of you. So that's why you're here, probably. But entanglement is very strange. And it's clearly non-local, and it's apparently acausal. You know, there are no causes involved in some of the aspects of it. And what this means is the conclusion would be that the end, if you just take the quantum world, the end is not built into the beginning. You're not just going to take quantum laws and predict individual events. Things are all interconnected, and they happen because of other things outside the situation. And that's what I mean by openness. All right, here's an early quote. You know, back in the days when they were struggling to even make sense of the quantum world in the first place, this is Percy Bridgman, who was a Nobel laureate in physics, and he also did a lot of philosophy. He says, "The structure of nature may eventually be such that our processes of thought do not correspond to it sufficiently to permit us to think about it at all. The world fades out and eludes us. We are confronted with something truly ineffable. We have reached the limit of the vision of the great pioneers of science, the vision, namely, that we live in a sympathetic world in that it is comprehensible to our minds." I may have a typo there, but it seems like he's saying that maybe we just can't understand quantum mechanics anyway. You know, maybe we're not up to the task. But let me just quickly remind you of the uncertainty principle. The one statement of it is that you cannot measure both position and momentum of a particle at the same time. Of course, there are a lot of other pairs of things you can't measure at the same time. But it goes further in the sense that combined with entanglement, it seems to indicate that these properties do not exist unless they are pinned down. Now, particles, the particles of quantum mechanics have wave-like nature, and this uncertainty principle, maybe most of you don't know, is actually just a wave-like phenomena, and the connection between momentum and wavelength, for example, makes that wave-like phenomena transfer into the particles. And so it becomes strange in the particle world, but it's a wave-like phenomena. Then the entanglement is that particles affect each other instantaneously, even though widely separated. The first one is, I have no time to talk about the double slit experiment. I suspect most of you have seen that. But that talks about the wave and particle nature. But I do want to get into entanglement. But first I'll say a couple things about the uncertainty, just to give you a picture. All right, momentum. Physics 101, mass times velocity. Motion, all right? Now, in the quantum world, momentum is related to the wavelength, which is lambda. And H over lambda, H is Planck's constant, a very small number. So you see a wave here, and the particle has a wavelength. And the wavelength, if it's very, very short, that means lambda is very, very small. It's in the denominator, so the momentum is very, very big, and vice versa. So long wavelength things have little momentum. Now, the uncertainty principle in mathematics says that the uncertainty in the position times the uncertainty in the momentum is bigger than a small number. A small number has H in it. And what does that uncertainty mean? Well, the uncertainty just means, think of a bell curve, right? Uncertainty is just how well can you measure something. You take a lot of measurements. If you get enough of them, it looks like a bell curve. And the width of the bell curve is the uncertainty. So what it's saying is this. Okay, suppose your position uncertainty, which is the spike thing over here, is pretty small, right? Well, if it gets too small, then the left-hand side of that equation would be smaller than the right-hand side, so it can't get too small. So the uncertainty in the momentum has to get bigger, and that's the broad peak down here. Now, if you broaden out the position uncertainty, then you can shrink in the momentum uncertainty. So there's this correlation that you can only know one of them with good accuracy and not the other, or both of them with relatively not so good accuracy. Okay, so now I'm going to get to entanglement. And what follows are some arguments that generally lead to the conclusion that two particles which are formally intertwined remain so and can affect each other instantaneously, even though very far apart. The phenomenon is known as entanglement. The reason that it occurs is because quantum particles don't behave like classical ones. We can't conceive them. They're not billiard balls. And the other side of it is, as I mentioned earlier, quantum mechanics is very works very well in describing the experiments. It works so well, in fact, that it just got to be right, at least to some very, very small scale. So, okay, so here's... Think of a charged particle spinning, all right? If you send a charged particle spinning through an inhomogeneous magnetic field, it deflects. And if you have a classical charged particle spinning, depending on its orientation of spin, that's, you know, the axis of rotation, it'll deflect in different directions, okay? That's the first step. But a quantum particle is different. If we take an electron which has so-called spin a half, and you send it through a magnetic field, it's going to either land in one of two places. It's never going to land in the middle, like the classical one would. It's only going to land in one of two places. Now, here's where the really interesting part comes. Suppose I rotate that magnet 20 degrees off, which is what we'll think about. It'll still land in only one of two places, but they'll be aligned up to the 20 degrees off magnet, you see. So the way you choose the direction of the magnet will determine what possibilities you have to come out. And that's really part of the source of the paradox. Now, Einstein, along with Podolsky and Rosen, proposed a thought experiment saying quantum mechanics got to be wrong because of this. He says, suppose you prepare, well, they didn't say it exactly this way, but this is the one of the more modern renditions. Suppose you prepare a particle which has spin zero, and that means it has total spin zero, and so if it decays into two parts, one of them has a spin in one direction, the other has to have a spin exactly in the opposite direction. That is, if you measure them along the same axis. So you do that. And if you do that, one will go up and then the other will go down. That will be what happens to them because they have opposite spin. And that's if the magnetic fields are lined up. But the question is, what if you change the axis? Well, here's Einstein's argument. He considered one of them vertical and the other one horizontal. And he says, in quantum mechanics, measuring spin on the x-axis and measuring spin on the y-axis, those are pairs that are uncertainty pairs. Just like position and momentum, you can't pin down angular momentum on the x-axis or spin and spin on the y-axis. So he says, you can't know both of them at the same time, but we're going to use a trick here. If we measure the x-axis on one side, but then we turn the other side over and we measure the y-axis on this side, we'll know that this one would have had to correlate with whatever the y-axis on the other side says. So then we'll actually know what happened, what the particle would have done on this side on the y-axis. And therefore, we would know the x and the y. Okay, so we have to measure this. So we measure the spin, the second spin along the y-axis, and we'll know both precisely. And that means that something's wrong with quantum mechanics. Okay, so I have to speed up. Now, it turns out that Einstein's assumption actually leads to something that does not agree with quantum mechanics. And John Bell showed that by deriving an inequality, which I'm going to quickly illustrate. The inequality is actually something that's very simple to derive, and it's not quantum mechanical. But the point is that quantum mechanics predicts a violation of this inequality. And as we said, quantum mechanics is the thing that works experimentally. So here's what you do. You think of three angles. I've got a 20 degree and I've got a 0 degree here, and we'll have a minus 20 degree. So we can envision measuring the particles at three different angles, and we ask the question, what is the probability of measuring one particle up at, if it would be up at 0 degrees and not up at 20 degrees, say? What's the probability of that? And so if you imagine that once these things decay, they don't affect each other anymore, then you can classify them into the particle that goes here. If I measure it at 0, 20, or minus 20, I'm going to get, it'll go up on all three, or it'll go up on the first two and down on the other, or it'll go down on one of them on the first one and up on the other two. So the only eight possible kinds of prepared particles you could get. And these eight, there's a graphical rendition of the eight. And, whoa, I keep bumping something else. But it turns out that an identical problem, probabilistically speaking, you can just think of a group of people. How many are left-handed in here? How many have blue eyes? How many have brown eyes? Left and right-handed, male and female. So you have different pairs. It's up and down, minus 20, up and down, 0, and up and down, 20. Those are the possibilities. Or we have possibilities of male, left-handed, female, you know, and so on. And ask the question, and what we can demonstrate is that the probability that the male and somebody is male and not left-handed, and plus the probability that somebody is left-handed and not brown eyes, is greater than or equal to somebody who's male and not brown eyes. And so here's a Venn diagram of that, right, left, you know, male, female, all divided up. Put some people in there to make it a little more visual. And we ask that question. Well, the first one is, the two X's there indicate the people who are male and not left-handed. The two X's in the second indicate the people who are left-handed and not brown eyes. And so the total of those is all the red four X's here. Now, that's clearly greater than or equal to the people who are male and not brown eyes, because that only gets two of the four X's that are in the upper box. And the point is, you can do exactly the same thing with the three sorts of measurements. Okay. So, once you do that, you prove a statement that if a particle would, what the probability of a particle going up at 20 degrees but not up at 0, plus the probability of it going up at 0 and not up at minus 20, is greater than or equal to the probability of the particle going up at 20 and not up at minus 20. And that's the inequality. And then we use Einstein's trick to look at one side, and so we know what the other side would do. And what do we get? Well, here's the summary. But quantum mechanics gives you this funny result, a sine function squared with some angles in it. That's the result that you derive if you actually do the calculation quantum mechanically. And so all we have to do is put our values in. And since 20 and 0, that's a difference between 20. That would give you the sine of 10. And then 20 and minus 20, that's a difference between 40 with a half angle there. You get a sine of 20. So we put it into the equation. And what do we get? Well, the result is that the inequality is violated. This is just the demonstration that quantum mechanics does not obey the inequality. So what does it mean? Okay, and that's the big question. What does it mean? We've got to include that some assumption we made is wrong, but the only assumption we made was that one particle is independent from the other particle once they leave each other. And so we must conclude that they are not independent, and that the choices of angles and measurements is going, one side is affecting the other side. And so there's, this is why we call it spooky action at a distance. Okay, well, now we got to get to the implications. it also gives you an indication that these properties don't actually exist in the interim until they're measured, which is also kind of spooky. And this is what I call openness. And it does illustrate that the end is not built into the beginning. Okay, but now I got to get back to the other aspects of the talk. Consider the following quote from a recent paper arguing for psychological determinism. That's the one I responded to. He said, according to some incompatibilists, morally, never mind what that means, but morally significant freedom requires ultimate indeterminacy of the act, or according to some compatibilists, indeterminacy of some relevant prior act by antecedent events and or states of affairs. The problem is that a causally underdetermined event, such as an act of choice that is free in the sense required by the incompatibilist, would ultimately be inexplicable. Well, if you parse out what he's saying there, what he's saying is exactly Einstein's argument against Bohr in this debate about the quantum mechanics. And that's what caused me, you know, a light bulb go on. Oh, he's assuming something here. And so why does it have to be that the prior act is explicable? I think he's assuming a kind of a mechanistic model for the psychology, which we already know is not true in the quantum world. So, well, one answer might be that he's assuming a mechanistic ontology under the surface and he doesn't really know it. But there are other areas we might point to. Psychological decision-making, that carries into social phenomena, economic, and so on. I don't think I have time for my doggy example, but they were able to teach a dog how to figure out a new thing that he didn't know the name of, but he could go get it. Very interesting kinds of things that animals do that appear to be free choices. Consider natural selection, you know, just going down the chain. The niche of animals in North America and Australia are filled by very different types of beings. I guess I'm getting close. So I got to get on with my... I only have two or three more slides, but I have to get on with the teleological argument. Here's my argument for openness from theology. The material world is not all that determines the future. The end is not built into the beginning. The quantum world makes perfect sense from that standpoint, if the end is not built in the beginning. Now, if we recall the assumption that the biological, psychological, etc. are not reducible one to the other, then each of them we might expect to have or exhibit some kind of similar openness. And so if we study it empirically, we can look for that. And that they wouldn't be derivable from physical laws. Now, since God's purposes are not primarily psychological or any of these things, then we would expect that that there is more to the story than any of the laws of nature that we see in any of these aspects. And I guess I'm getting close. All right. So finally, what are the implications? Openness is a creational thing. It says nothing about how God brings about his own purposes. In other words, from the standpoint of creation, that is, we might call laws of nature, the future is undetermined. So we see the openness considering only the laws that we see, but God is free to interact at all levels of the openness through his spirit presence in any way in this picture. And so what does that have to do with theology? Well, you can actually choose your theology on this model because a hyper-Calvinist God could be, well, God works in the openness to just do everything. An open theism on the other side, you know, way on the other end, God waits to see what creation does and reacts to it. So God is changing because of creation's openness. Some people have actually argued that. Or anything in between. So in other words, this model does not constrain God's divine action, and my own view is somewhat in the between, you know, Calvinist view with a genuine free, creaturely free will, and I guess I stop there.
Okay. Thank you very much, John.